Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey there, I'm Claire Thornton, and this is Five Things. It's Sunday, January 24th. These Sunday episodes are special. We're giving you more from in-depth stories you may have already heard. Even though procedural matters will remain the same now that we have a woman vice president, it can't be denied that Kamala Harris is allowing our country to reimagine the vice presidency. Here's just one example. You're listening to the first military march ever composed for a woman vice president. It's called Madam Vice President, and it premiered last weekend. As the first Black woman and South Asian person to hold the office, Vice President Harris is a trailblazer. She now has one of the most powerful voices in the world. And we've never had a second gentleman before. USA Today reporter Charisse Jones profiled Doug Emhoff, the vice president's husband, earlier this week on the show. Here's a longer version of Charisse's segment from earlier this week.
He really represents something that is actually quite normal in American life, but isn't usually represented on a public stage. And so he basically quit his job. He was at the top of his profession, a partner in a prominent firm in California, entertainment lawyer, and he quit. And the reason on its face was that he didn't want any conflicts of interest. But the bigger reason is he wants to be supportive of his wife, Kamala Harris, as she steps into a position of power. And there are so many women across this country who are the breadwinners in their families. But again, it's just not something you see at that level of American life. And so I think that's very meaningful to a lot of people. He, just like his wife, really broadens the imagination, right? In American life, white men are centered in corporate positions of power, in political life, in political positions of power. And to see him not be the person at the helm and in the spotlight, but actually assist her taking her place in the spotlight, is something that's very different, but really necessary to see at a moment in this country where we're really reckoning with racism, the legacy of racism, and people trying to get their arms around and their heads around a very diverse population that has a lot to bring to the table. I also think that because he's an attorney, I mean, he's talked about, when he started out, walking the halls of a courthouse and seeing all of the young people who were literally tugging on him and saying, help, I need help, please help me. And so access to justice, to equity, is something that he may really want to delve into as the second gentleman. So, I mean, we'll see. He hasn't really, hammered out what he wants to do, but I would think that his legal expertise will come in handy in that regard. I think that their family is really interesting because it's also emblematic of American identity in a way that we don't always talk about. Kamala Harris is his second wife, and so she's got stepchildren who've really embraced her. And so they're a blended family, which is something that we see a lot, obviously, in the culture. They're a diverse family. He is Jewish. She's obviously Black and Jamaican and Indian ancestry. She apparently gets along great with his first wife. And so it's just really interesting to see a family at that level of limelight and in terms of the people that are going to be able to look upon them that also see themselves in that family. And I think that that is a really interesting and important thing for us to see as a nation. And I think, though, we're talking about Doug Emhoff, Jill Biden is also very interesting because she's going to continue to teach. And she teaches at a community college. She did that all through her 8 years as second lady. And she wants to continue to do that. And I think at a moment when we're dealing with a pandemic that has, you know, really decimated women in the workforce, you know, we're taking on a lot of the load at home, juggling remote schooling. Many women have lost their jobs. In December, 156,000 women lost their positions in the workplace, which was basically every job that was lost that month. And more than 2 million women have exited the workforce since the pandemic began. So to see a woman that's going to continue to work while her husband is in the White House, and then to see a man who's going to allow his wife to be the dominant player in that space is just really great to see. And I think it really harkens a new moment that this country really needs.
Reporter Alia Dostiger talked to young women of color about what Vice President Harris's inauguration meant to them. They told Alia that because of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, they couldn't truly celebrate until they heard Vice President Harris's oath on Inauguration Day. Now, Vice President Harris will be an example for them every day.
I spoke with two young women of color for this story, as well as a 7-year-old, which was refreshing. The first woman I spoke with, a young Black woman who is a junior at Howard University, she had not really been able to tap into some of those things that maybe she had expected to feel because so many things sort of politically right now feel so precarious. You know, having seen the violence at the Capitol earlier this month and just sort of living in this era, I think, now where so many things are uncertain and keep hearing the word unprecedented, it was hard for her to sort of absorb the gravity of the moment. And I think she told me she was really looking forward to the inauguration because she felt like it would really be, she expected it to be when some of those things that she had been kind of not letting herself feel would finally sort of come out. She told me she's a very emotional person, but she hasn't cried yet. She expected to cry. She was waiting for those words. She wanted to hear those words. She wanted to hear that oath before I think it could all really sort of sink in for her. And then I spoke to another young woman of color, an Indian American. Both her parents are Indian. She's an immigrant herself. And she shared something sort of similar, though slightly different, in that I think she had been able to tap into her emotion around what Harris had achieved. She remembers being in the grocery store when she found out finally that Biden and Harris had won. I say finally because it was, sort of a very prolonged process in getting the election result. And so she told me she cried in the grocery store. She cried after Harris delivered her victory speech. But she said she hadn't really properly celebrated because of some of the same reasons, just a fear of violence, the aftermath of violence, more violence kind of looming, crisis after crisis after crisis. You know, it was kind of like, now this thing has happened and now we have to go solve, the next kind of problem. So there wasn't really a moment to sort of pause and really kind of take it all in. And so she was also very much looking forward to inauguration as a time to really kind of let it all sink in and kind of take a breath. The last person I spoke to for the story was a young Black girl, a second grader, a 7-year-old. I asked her, I said, do you remember where you were, like when you found out that Harris had won? And she said, my dad told me, and I asked her what he said. And she said, he told me I can be anything that I want to be. She said her parents told me that she wanted to be, when she grows up, she wants to be a music teacher. and an artist. She said what she loved about Kamala was that she likes all kids. She likes all kinds of kids, and she likes all kinds of people. And you know, experts that I spoke to for this story said that it's so important for someone to have this kind of example of accomplishment. These things are really hard for parents to sometimes readily kind of identify, whether it's because it's lacking in, you know, school curriculum, or there just aren't kind of enough, you know, Black characters in the movies and the television shows. That one of the experts told me it's just like kind of like an additional layer of work that Black parents often have to do with their kids because they're just not seeing that or getting that in the way many white children are.
Vice President Kamala Harris brings a set of strengths all her own to the role, especially from her time on the Senate Intelligence and Homeland Security Committees. Political reporter Rebecca Morin says that Harris's identity as a woman of color will also redefine the vice presidency.
Joe Biden has said so many times that he wants a full governing partner. The person he chose is going to be the first person in and the last person to leave the room. And so far, that's kind of what we've seen. We've seen Kamala Harris throughout the transition right by Joe Biden's side. So we saw Al Gore, you know, he focused on the environment when he was vice president to Bill Clinton. But what we're going to see from Kamala Harris is going to be a lot of what we saw, you know, President Obama delegated what he thought Joe Biden would do best and what was the most urgent for him to do. And so Biden has said he's going to do the same thing with Kamala Harris. She's going to take on the urgent business that Biden can get to. She's making history, you know, as the first, you know, woman of color, not just woman of color, but a Black woman, a South Asian woman, vice president. So in itself, that's already a big deal, and it's going to change a lot of how she is, you know, being reported on, but also just like kind of her role, because she's just going to be more front and center than, you know, Vice President Mike Pence was. So she's going to have a huge role on Capitol Hill. You know, she is the tie-breaking vote, whether it be for like the COVID relief package that Biden recently introduced. We don't know. And we don't know. There are still a lot of Republican senators who are more a little bit more moderate and like have flipped in favor of Democrats. And so who knows how much she'll be actually be on the Hill, but, you know, she's going to still have to play a big role, even in just having relations with a lot of the senators on the Hill. She'll probably travel a lot for foreign policy. Another big issue is that, you know, her and Joe Biden are going to work a lot on this sort of racial justice, this sort of reckoning that the United States is having on systemic racism. And systemic racism, it's not just a one issue thing, you know, it involves a lot of different parts. And so some things that people want to see is kind of digging into this racial disparity involving COVID and like their economic ramifications, and want to see something really big on that. Want to see her maybe take the lead and trying to, you know, figure out what is going wrong and how, you know, this doesn't happen again.
The Harris-Biden team got to work quickly on Inauguration Day, in part because there was less pomp and circumstance than normal this year. Deputy Washington Bureau Chief Karen Bowen has more.
So there have been a lot of executive orders that Biden has issued, and a lot of times when people talk about the day one agenda, in a lot of presidencies, that means that the Inauguration Day is reserved for the pomp and circumstance and the speeches and, you know, the ceremonies and the inaugural balls. Biden did it a little bit differently in that he started the business of governing, like, right away. The White House issued a series of executive orders, including erasing some of President Trump's orders on rolling back the Muslim ban. There have been orders on mask mandates in airports, and there was an order rejoining the Paris climate deal. It's been quicker in that, you know, we had a White House press briefing on Inauguration Day a few hours after Biden took the oath, and White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki came to the podium and kicked off that tradition of having the press ask questions and outlining the agenda. So one of the things that is part of the shift in tone is there's already a lot more predictability. There is a schedule that we're getting every day from Biden's White House telling us what he's going to do during the day. We knew that he was going to have a speech on the pandemic. We knew that there were going to be a series of executive orders. We are told that we can now expect daily White House briefings. In the Trump White House, there were a lot of policies that were announced via tweet, and that seems like that's not going to happen very much in this administration at all. President Trump preferred to be very freewheeling about his schedule. There was very little about the Trump White House that one would call a routine in terms of how announcements were made and things like that. There were last-minute schedule shifts. Appointments of cabinet figures were often announced out of the blue. You know, there was a lot less sort of regiment and structure to how things were done. One big sign of the shift in tone came when Dr. Anthony Fauci appeared this week at the podium of the White House briefing room. It was almost like a sense of an alternative universe. We had seen Dr. Fauci appear several times alongside President Trump and other coronavirus advisors last spring in the early days of the pandemic. But many times there were signs of tension between the president and Fauci. The president had a much more upbeat assessment of where the virus was headed than Fauci did. And in the case of the Biden administration, Fauci has been given an elevated role as Biden's top coronavirus advisor. And so when he took the podium and fielded questions about issues such as the vaccine rollout, it was almost a sense of this is Fauci unleashed. And Fauci himself even said it was a liberating feeling to be able to answer questions from reporters and not have to worry that he would say something that might contradict the president.
And here's one more segment. Donald Trump has over $300 million of debt that will influence what he does next. Earlier this week, business reporter Nathan Bomey came on the show to discuss how Trump could rebrand himself after leaving the White House. Here's that segment again with bonus material we didn't originally air.
Looking back at the last 4 years, it would be really difficult to argue that the brand has increased in value. I think it's pretty clearly been tarnished, and especially in the last couple weeks. I mean, even before the riots at the Capitol, his brand was in trouble. But now that the insurrection has occurred and we have seen some, you know, companies starting to get cold feet about being associated with politicians who supported the, you know, overturning the election results, of course, Donald Trump being the leader of that movement, I think that we're going to see some companies that are not willing to do business with him anymore. And if that happens, then, you know, the value of his brand has taken a significant hit. We're not talking about a minor blemish here. This is, you know, could be existential for some of his key business deals, because we've already seen organizations like the PGA of America pull out of the 2022 PGA Championship, which was going to be held at one of his golf courses. So that's not a good sign for the value of his brand. Deutsche Bank had historically been willing to extend financing to him, but we're seeing indications that that may be coming to an end. And, you know, to do any of the sort of major business deals that Donald Trump has historically done, you know, in particular real estate transactions that often require debt, he's going to have to take out loans. And I'm not sure that there are many financiers out there who are willing to extend that kind of debt to him anymore, because, you know, this is someone who, of course, has the challenges of politics now, but also he has the challenge of the fact that he has a track record of not paying his bills on time and has gone bankrupt for in many of his companies before. And you don't want to be a lender in that particular situation. So you might just look at his business and say, I think I'll pass. So that's another crisis he's facing. We know that he has at least $300 million in debt due over the next few years. So that's going to come due quickly. And I think that that will actually influence what he does. I mean, he's going to have to get cash flow going because he can't just sit there and do nothing. You know, I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's possible that his current cash flow could end up allowing him to pay off those debts. But I think the general consensus is that he could be underwater on those loans, which means that basically he doesn't have the kind of financing right now that he would need to be able to pay those off on time. And so, you know, could he refinance the debt? That's a really important question. You know, there's a joke in the financing world that I actually quoted someone saying in this article that essentially is like, if you owe $40 to the bank and you can't pay, then you're in trouble. But if you owe $40 million to the bank and you can't pay, then the bank's in trouble. So, you know, that could be the case here where although he might not be able to pay it off, bank might not want to push him into bankruptcy because then that could end up being a bad result for them. So they may try to work out something. It's a huge crisis for him. You know, the fact that the pandemic is now going on, you know, well over 10 months has dealt a huge blow to his businesses. I mean, he relies heavily on travel spending and especially luxury travel. And, you know, so his hotels and golf resorts in particular have really taken it on the chin. And so I think, you know, it's no clear sign that that's going to improve anytime soon. Now, there is a lot of hope out there that when the pandemic finally starts to subside, that there will be a real big increase in travel spending. I know I'm eager to travel. So I do think that some people will go back. But the question is, will they go back to Trump properties? And with everything that's happened, you know, if you've got another choice and politics influences the way you spend your money, which it really does for a lot of people now who are socially conscious about what they do with their wallet, you know, maybe you go somewhere else. So, and especially if you're like a meeting planner for, or, you know, say you're planning a convention, are you going to put your convention in a Trump hotel? You know, you might just pass and say, let's do it somewhere that's not going to draw as much controversy. You know, if half the people in your association are going to be upset and the other half's going to not, you know, that's just something you don't want to deal with. Now, one important thing to say, though, is that, you know, Trump, it still has a lot appeal to a lot of people. I mean, obviously, 74 million plus people voted for him, and whether or not they would spend money with him is probably a different question. But at the very least, he has a big base of support. And I think the question is, can he capitalize on that going forward? And if he wants to and tries to, which I think he will, he may have to pivot toward more of a middle America, red state kind of play. You know, he had a series of hotels he wanted to open up that was geared more toward budget travelers kind of in middle America, but that plan fell apart in 2019, and there's no signs that it's going to get any traction, certainly not in the middle of a pandemic. I think everyone's wondering if Donald Trump could be essentially the next Rush Limbaugh. I mean, obviously Limbaugh never been president, but he's certainly an extremely influential voice, arguably one of the most influential conservatives in America. And obviously, if Donald Trump were to go into radio, he would instantly be in a similar position. I think there's two problems here, though. Number one is he really willing to put in the kind of work that's necessary there? I mean, to show up every day, you know, to do, say, 2-3 hours of radio or something like that. I mean, that's tough. It's easier said than done to say, well, radio is a good fit. And the other problem is, you know, the financing to do it. If he wants to do, say, his own streaming service, for example, how is he going to get the kind of capital to start that kind of thing? So it's enticing probably for him in the sense that it would allow him to stay in the game. And the same thing with TV. If he were to want to do some sort of TV network, you know, the idea of Trump TV has been thrown out there many times. But again, how do you get the startup capital? That's expensive to do. And, you know, that could be tough and actually end up preventing it from getting off the ground.
Look for the inauguration tab at the top of the screen on usatoday.com, where you can purchase special inauguration editions of the paper. And our politics team has a fantastic new Instagram account. Follow them for photos, videos, and more out of Washington at USA Today Politics on Instagram. If you liked this episode of Five Things, tell your friends and family about the show. We always love reaching new listeners. Taylor Wilson will be back tomorrow morning with Five Things You Need to Know for Monday. Thanks for being here. I'm Claire Thornton. See you next Sunday. Until then, keep up with me on Twitter. I'm at Claire_THORNTO.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.